Well, what I want to show you is how to deobfuscate it using a standalone JavaScript interpreter called SpiderMonkey. It's part of the Mozilla project, so the same scripting engine that's part of Firefox is SpiderMonkey. SpiderMonkey allows you to run JavaScript outside of the browser, and it allows you to see what the script would have done if it executed within the browser. So we can take a script like this and execute it in SpiderMonkey and look at the output of the script. What's the output of the script? Document.write xorg stir. So the script will deobfuscate itself, and we're going to just look at the output of that script, which should be the deobfuscated version of the script. Does that make sense? We don't need to set any breakpoints. We don't need to interact with anything. SpiderMonkey is easy to script. Let me show you what's involved in doing that. SpiderMonkey is already installed on Remnex. And this is documented, by the way, on page 136. I'm going to show it to you and then give you a chance to play with this in your lab. So this is in malware day 4. And I'm going to unzip this particular example, which is storm.zip. If you want to look at what at the script, I would use Notepad, storm.js. This is what that script looks like. Lots and lots of encoded stuff. We don't want to do this manually. Yeah. But what if we could execute the script in a JavaScript interpreter and simply look at the output? The output of this should be the deobfuscated version of the script. To call SpiderMonkey on Remnex, you just type JS. JS stands for JavaScript. That's how you invoke SpiderMonkey. Dash F specifies the file that you want to execute. So I'm going to execute storm.js. And I'm going to run it. Click. Now, SpiderMonkey runs the script, but it gives us an error. Let me show you this error on the screen. The error says, document is not defined. What's that about? Well, if you remember the script that we're looking at, it is calling a function write that's part of the object document, document.write. Here's the problem. The problem is that document is an object that is supposed to be defined by the browser. The browser is supposed to define document. Because we're running the script outside of the browser, document is not defined. So there's an error when we execute the script in SpiderMonkey. What to do? Well, how about we define this object ourselves? It takes a little bit of JavaScript, but the syntax is pretty easy. Here's how you would do this. You can create a file, a text file, and using this JavaScript syntax, you would define the object document, and within it, you would define a method write. And you're saying, whenever a script calls document.write, what I really want you to do is just to print. Print whatever it's trying to write, because print is defined without any browser. Another alternative that a lot of JavaScript will do is document.writeln. We're going to also define it as print. Similarly, if we're dealing with a JavaScript, then instead of calling document.write, if it's calling eval, we don't really want to eval. We don't want to run a malicious script, not necessarily. What we want to do is maybe simply print whatever it would have evaluated. The idea is that whenever a malicious script tries to execute the deobfuscated script, we're going to print what it's trying to execute to the screen. Does this make sense to you? The syntax, well, this is JavaScript. And if anytime you see JavaScript call a method that for some reason is not defined because the browser was supposed to define it, you can use syntax like this to define it yourself. Yes?
If you print to the screen, though, you may lose if there's a lot of data.
You're saying, but if I print to the screen, what if it's really large?
Yeah.
It's going to scroll past me. Yes, absolutely right. That's why usually when we're going to execute SpiderMonkey, we're going to redirect the output to a file.
Okay.
Yep, and I'll show you how to do that. So, here's how we're going to do that. Here's the good news. The good news is that I already defined these and many other objects for you. There's a file that I wanted to show you on Remnex that I stored in user local Etsy. It's called web.obj.js. It's a sizable file, and in it, I defined several other, there's quite a few of these objects that malicious scripts try to call. And I've tried to define those that I typically see. Document.write, document.write, document.createElement, body.appendChild. There's a bunch of these that JavaScript will be trying to define. I define most of the ones that you're likely to encounter. And if you encounter something that I didn't anticipate, just edit the script and add, using the syntax that you see here, whatever you need. So that script is under more Etsy. Oh, oops, it's under user local Etsy web.obj.js. I defined a bunch of common objects here for you. And actually, the objects that you see here are not just for browser scripts, but if you ever do PDF analysis, I defined objects that Adobe Acrobat defines in the script as well. So you can use the script for PDF analysis, which is not something we're going to get into anyway. All right, so what do I do now? So now that I have defined those common browser objects in a separate file, and I did it so you don't have to, now I'm going to call JS again to run the storm JavaScript. But in addition to executing this particular script, I'm also going to specify on the command line -f user local etsy web obj.js. So what I'm saying is, first load my own definitions of these objects and then execute the malicious script. And now when I run this, now I actually see some output. No more errors. And of course the output scrolls past the screen, so I'm going to redirect this, call it out.txt, and I use Notepad to look at the results. Notepad out.txt. Notepad out.txt. When I first opened this, I thought it didn't work because I see a blank screen. Actually, it did work. There's just a bunch of new lines. If you scroll down, you do see the deobfuscated script. All right. And for example, we see a reference to some malicious URL. It's not formatted very cleanly, but it is readable and you can reformat it and understand what it does. It has been deobfuscated. So it was pretty easy to do. What we had to do is simply execute the script in SpiderMonkey, notice which objects are missing, and then define those objects so that they're no longer missing. I already defined the most common objects for you, and so now you can call JS, load the file that I already gave you that defines the most common objects, and look at the results. The script runs, deobfuscates itself, and prints itself out to the screen. And now it's there for you to analyze without worrying about obfuscation. Give that a try. The instructions for this begin on page 136 in the fourth book, 136. And they end on page 139. So 136 through 139. One more thing I wanted to point out to you as a resource available to you on Remnux is that if you don't like the file that I created, webobj.js, that's fine. I'm not going to take it personally. There's another, an alternative available on Remnux as well. It's under remnux/jsunpack-n-pre.js. It's Blake Hartstein actually defined it. His own. I mean, try one. If it doesn't work, you can try the other one. I find that mine works in most cases. Another resource available to you in Remnux is a customized version of SpiderMonkey. The version of SpiderMonkey that I had already installed in Remnux, I actually compiled it myself and I tweaked it a little bit so that not only does it evaluate scripts, but it'll also print them out even if you did not define your own custom JavaScript to do so. If whatever, for whatever reason you run my script, it doesn't work, my version of SpiderMonkey, you've got another one installed on Remnux that was created by Didier Stevens. He also automatically defines some common browser objects for you. And the way, if you wanted to try it out, you can invoke it instead of saying JS, you would type JS-Didier. So this is Didier's version of SpiderMonkey. It's a slightly older version, compiled a little bit differently. If one doesn't work for some reason, try the other one. Any questions about using SpiderMonkey to do this sort of stuff? This is a very powerful, a very flexible method. Let's say you're dealing with a script that's got multiple layers of obfuscation. What you would have to do is deobfuscate it once, copy the deobfuscated script, paste it into the original one, just like we did on the second day of the class, and then run it through SpiderMonkey again. But I find that this is better, more convenient than setting breakpoints, because this is easier for me to just... It's harder for me to make a mistake when I do this, I find. It also lends itself well to scripting and automation. SpiderMonkey is the same scripting engine as what is used by Firefox. So this works particularly well if you're analyzing a script that was designed to run within Firefox. Another tool I wanted to mention to you is the Rhino Debugger. You know what? As I said, I like having multiple tools that do similar things because sometimes one tool works, the other one doesn't. Rhino is a debugger for debugging JavaScript. Similar to how Firebug debugs JavaScript. But the thing about Rhino is that it's a standalone debugger, so it runs outside of the browser. You don't need to run Firefox to run Rhino. The caveat, though, is that Rhino cannot handle HTML. It only understands JavaScript. So if you've got a malicious web page, you'll need to get rid of HTML markup to only leave JavaScript. And then you can debug it using Rhino. Let me show you how that works. Rhino, just like most scripting debuggers, cannot set a breakpoint in the middle of the line. Remember, this was also a limitation of Firebug. So if you want to use Rhino, I'm going to use the same script as we've used before. If you want to use Rhino, you'll need to make sure that you're going to have a line where you want to set the breakpoint in the beginning of the line. So I'm going to edit the storm.js file and add a new line character so that... I think I did something wrong here. Yeah, I'm going to add a new line character so the document.write is on a line by itself. Now I save, and now I run Rhino. To run Rhino, you type rhino-debugger. I invoke the storm.js. All right, so I'm debugging the script that I just modified. And now, here's the script. I can visually locate the line where I want to set the breakpoint, which is document.write. It's on a line by itself, so I'll have no problem setting a breakpoint. Right-click on it, say set breakpoint, and then click go. Click. And now I have reached my breakpoint. What's the name of the variable that I want to look at? xord_str. To look at a variable in Rhino, I need to type its name in the expression cell. xord_str. Enter. You see ... appeared under value? The value is in there. The easiest way I found to get it out of there is to click there and press Ctrl+C. To copy to the clipboard. Then I open an instance of Notepad and paste it in. A little caveat, Rhino supports edit, copy, but this doesn't quite work. So don't do it, just click on it and press Ctrl+C. Ctrl+C works just fine. So now you have yet another way to deobfuscate stuff like that. You could have used Firebug, or you can use Rhino, or you could use SpiderMonkey. And because this is just like using Firebug, I'm not going to do it as an exercise together. If you want, you're welcome to play with this if you have some time. Here's a tool that we have not talked about before, and I think this is a really, really nice tool. It's called Malzilla. Malzilla is a tool that runs on Microsoft Windows, and it's written specifically for analyzing browser-based malware. It's a specialized browser malware analysis tools. Includes really cool, handy features. How do you use it? Let me show you. For this, I got my Microsoft virtual machine ready. And I'm gonna open Malzilla. Also, I'm gonna extract that example that we've been using so far, storm.js. Put it on my desktop. So to load a script into Mozilla, you gotta go into the decoder tab. I have all this in the book. You gotta go into the decoder tab. Then you right click on the tab and you say load from file. And I'm gonna load the malicious script. So now on the top of this window, you see a script that I'm trying to analyze. How do I deobfuscate it? Easy. All I need to do is click a button, run script. Click. Compiled script is also a script. Okay, good. Now, it looks like it didn't work. I got confused the first time it happened to me. It worked. I just got to scroll down there. Maybe I'm just paranoid, or maybe it's just a defensive measure. But yeah, here is that deobfuscated script. And in fact, it's nicely formatted and even colorized for my analysis. What Mozilla does is very similar to what we did manually when we ran SpiderMonkey. It's just that Mozilla also automatically defines the necessary browser objects, so we don't have to worry about defining those. At least most of the common objects it can define automatically. So this approach is similar to what we would do using SpiderMonkey. But now you have a nice GUI tool that runs on Windows. And now you can examine this. You might notice that there's some stuff here that's still encoded. This does not mean that there is yet another script hidden in here, because in many cases, these malicious scripts will use encodings to encode shellcode that is used as part of an exploit. Shellcode is x86 instructions. You cannot just paste them into a script. They have to be properly encoded. And so in many cases, when you see an encoding like this, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's another layer of obfuscation. This very well could be just shellcode that was part of the script that's going to be used to target some kind of a vulnerability. Now, Mozilla is really cool because you can do other things out of it. For example, it's got a download tab so that if you don't want to use wget or Firefox or Internet Explorer, you can paste the URL at the bottom of the screen. And if you're connected to the Internet, it can go and retrieve the malicious web page. It even gives you a convenient way of spoofing your user agent and modifying your referrer field. It's convenient. All of these features in one box. You also have a MISC decoders tab that support various common ways of encoding content within scripts, like encoding content in hexadecimal or in Unicode. So if you think you see content that you're wondering about, like this one, you can try decoding it. You can try to highlight it, or actually at the bottom, sorry. You can try taking this, copying it to the clipboard. You can go to the MISC decoders tab, you can paste it in. And then if you select the appropriate encoding, like this one, you can try to decode it. Now this is not meant to be decoded because, as I said, it looks like it's embedded shellcode. So there are no corresponding ASCII characters, so it's not all that useful to us. But in many cases, this encoding would be used to conceal some kind of a string. So Mozilla makes it easy for you to decode that string. I would like to give you a few minutes to try Mozilla with this example. So please go to your Windows virtual machine, grab a copy of storm.js, and load it into the decoder tab of Mozilla, run the script, make sure you're able to see the deobfuscated script, and remember, you may need to scroll down to see the results of the script. Continue. Let's continue because there's still some cool stuff that I want to make sure we have time to get to. So we talked about the common tools that are used for JavaScript deobfuscation. A lot of people like doing this sort of stuff on Linux because if the script is targeting a vulnerability on Windows, Linux is less likely to be susceptible to it. SpiderMonkey is probably the most popular tool if you want to automate things. Rhino and Firebug allow you to do things in a debugger interactively. Mozilla is a really convenient specialized tool as well. What I want to show you is some of the more complex obfuscation techniques that I think can easily confuse you, and my hope is to show them to you so that you don't get confused. I'm going to show you an example of where multiple layers of obfuscation are used and how you can use SpiderMonkey to bypass that. I'll show you how several encodings are used to confuse you. And lastly, there are some really, what I think are pretty creative techniques that I will explain to you how they work so that if you encounter them, you don't get confused by them. One of the more fundamental obfuscation technique involves in using non-ASCII encodings. What do I mean by that? Well, we're used to looking at text, at script contents using ASCII, like letters A, B, C, etc., the English, the Latin alphabet. Well, there are various ways of representing a Latin, an English letter using a non-ASCII character. For example, you could represent it using its ASCII value, like A is actually 65. Or you could represent it using its value in hexadecimal, 41, using slash X, or using percent. There's also a Unicode encoding for these characters. So percent 0041 is the same thing as A. As human beings, we have a hard time looking at things that are non-ASCII characters. But browsers don't care. So what you see in many cases are script contents encoded using one of these encodings. And one of these encodings that is particularly popular is implemented using the JavaScript escape method. The escape function is supposed to convert a string into a URL-friendly string that a script can pass on a URL without breaking anything. And a lot of malicious scripts use escape to obfuscate a function, and then the script automatically retrieves the original string by using unescape. So here's an example of something like this. I'm going to show this to you on my screen and in my slides because I want you to know how to deal with this. This is actually not very complicated. This is an example that's on your DVD. It's in a file called unescape.zip. And if you look at that file, if you extract it and you look at it using Notepad, you will see that it is an HTML file, so there is HTML here as well as JavaScript. And the script uses document.write, and then it uses a call for unescape to decode this string. %30C, %5C, %43. These look like hexadecimal values of ASCII characters. When the script runs, it will be written out to the browser, and the browser will execute unescape to deobfuscate it automatically. How can we do this? How can we unescape it conveniently? Several different ways. One way is to create a Perl regular expression. Let me show you quickly how that works. We won't have time to get into regular expressions at depth, but here's the general idea. You see, what you can do in Perl is you can tell it how to replace certain values in a string, and the logic for what to replace and how to replace it can be quite complex. So here's the syntax, just so that you know what these regular expressions are like. What I'm saying here is I'm using Perl because I like the way Perl implements regular expression. I'm specifying -pe so that Perl allows me to specify my command on the command line without having to create it as a separate file. And here's my command. I'm using the s command to substitute strings. And the s command allows me to define what I'm substituting with what. Here, in the first part of the substitute command, what I'm saying is that Perl should locate percent sign. Notice that these are percent signs that are encoding my string. So I'm going to tell Perl to locate a percent sign and then to locate two characters that follow the percentile. In the regular expression, these two characters are represented by two dots. Because I included two characters, two dots, in parentheses, this tells Perl to save these two characters into a temporary variable $1. Why $1? Because it's the first match. Why dollar sign? Because we like dollars. No, because that's how Perl represents variables. So now, if it finds these two characters that follow a percent sign, it saves them into a variable called $1. And the next part of the expression tells Perl how to manipulate that variable to translate it. And what I'm saying is take this variable, $1, and treat it as a hex character, and then take that hex character and translate it into a regular character using CHR. This will automatically look at these hex values and convert them into corresponding character. And lastly, I'm saying that GE, which means do this globally for all such matches within the file, E is what allows me to specify functions, expressions, rather than regular plain search and replace methods. Then, as input into this command, I provide my encoded script, and I save the output into a text file. And now if you look at the output, here it is, the decoded version of the script. I looked at these hex values, and I used a Perl regular expression to translate them into a corresponding script. If you want more information about how to create these Perl regular expressions, I've got an advanced comprehensive, well-written example documented for you in the appendix to this book. We're not going to go through it together, but if you're interested, there's an appendix that walks you through how you can build these regular expressions for decoding scripts like this. And it is useful to know how to do this, because sometimes you're going to come across some non-standard encoding that you don't want to have to decode manually. A regular expression can really be helpful. But let's say you don't know how to write regular expressions. What else can you do instead of doing this? Well, another option for you is just to run this script in SpiderMonkey. How do you do this? Well, I told you that you can run SpiderMonkey using JS. I'm executing the script in onescape.html, but remember that I may need to define additional objects. That's why I'm also specifying as one of the parameter my webobj file. This will define browser-specific objects in JavaScript. One more thing that I'm not showing you here, but I do have a note on it. SpiderMonkey only accepts HTML. It does not accept HTML. It only accepts JavaScript. So before you do this, you will need to manually remove all HTML from this file. And if you run it, and if you look at the output is going to be the same as what I showed you on the previous slide. So this is yet another way to deobfuscate this script. But notice, when I run the script, it does produce some output, but it also produces an error. The error says that BAFFGQQRJ is not defined. What's up with that? Well, the reason it's an error is because actually I'm dealing with multiple layers of obfuscation here. If you look at the script that I just deobfuscated, it in itself is an obfuscated script. How do I deal with a problem like this? We've already encountered it before. What you need to do is now you need to copy this snippet that you just deobfuscated and paste it in to the original file in place of document.write or in place eval, and then you would repeat this experiment the second time. And hopefully the result will be deobfuscated. If not, you may need to do it the third time and the fourth time and so on. Is there a debugger like GDB for JavaScript? Well, yes and no. There are plenty of debuggers for JavaScript. Like Rhino is what I showed you earlier, is a debugger for JavaScript. Firebug is another one. So yeah, and I'm going to show you another one later on. You want it to be command line. I believe there is a way to do things from Firebug on the command line. Not the Unix command line, but the console that Firebug gives you. There are ways in which you can type commands there. So I guess the answer is still yes and no. Yet another option is to decode it in Mozilla. So you can take this encoded script, paste it into Mozilla, run script, it's going to deobfuscate it for you. Of course, just the first layer of obfuscation. And yet another way to do this in Mozilla is to go to the MISC decoders tab and say decode hex. This is a common encoding that Mozilla can decode for you. So you click decode hex and it's going to produce this result for you. You see a lot of tools, a lot of possibilities. But the challenge, of course, is that this is still an encoded script. So you will need to copy this, paste it into the original one, and go through this process again. And this is what I did. I pasted the decoded script into the original one. Now when I run it with SpiderMonkey, it actually produces the output that I can read and understand what it does. This is an example that's documented in your books. At some point, if you're curious about this sort of stuff, go through the example. You will see how it works. There's another interesting technique that I wanted to show you in case you come across it, because it can be really confusing, but it's easy to bypass. Sometimes, I don't know if it happened to you, you might come across a script and you look at it, and this is what it looks like. You don't see any JavaScript in there. You don't see anything there. What in the world is this? Well, this is what is sometimes called an 8-bit ASCII encoding. You see, to represent an ASCII character, all you really need is 7 bits. So what a malware author might do is he might have a little script that takes his original script and it goes through each one of those bytes and it flips the highest order bit, flips it to 1. When we look at it, the result looks like gibberish, but when a browser sees it, it's able to execute it just fine. How do you deal with such a problem? The only way that I found to deal with it is to create a regular expression, but don't worry because I already created the regular expression for you. It is documented at the bottom of the slide. What this regular expression does is it looks through every single byte in the script and it basically uses this bit mask to flip the highest order bit to what it should be. And that's it. And once you run it through the regular expression, then you will be able to read the script just like a normal script. I have an example like this in Remnix. If you want, give it a try. But I'm going to continue because there are some really cool things I wanted to show you. These are some defensive techniques that are just pretty innovative, I think. Here's an... Yeah.
How do you determine that it's 8-bit?
Say that again?
How do you determine that it's...
How would you determine that this is the encoding that's being used?
Yes.
It's very simple for me. When I open a file and it looks like nothing is there is readable to me, right away I think probably 8-bit encoding. And if you... Yeah, it's always like that. Yeah. And so if I think it might be this 8-bit encoding, then I... and by the way, I don't know the official name for this. I mean, this is kind of what I made up for it. But if you see it like that, then you try that Perl regular expression, and if it works, then you are right. If not, then you'll need to start thinking, well, what else could it be? Yeah, but I haven't seen anything else that does it in this strange way. Okay, so let's look at a few more defensive techniques that are part of malicious scripts. Here's an excerpt from a script that can easily confuse you. And the reason it's a little confusing is because it's just hard to say what's going on here. What the attacker has done is he has taken his obfuscated script and he split it up into tiny little chunks. And each one of those little chunks is within the HTML script tags. This is hard because if you try to run a script like this in SpiderMonkey, it won't work, because SpiderMonkey cannot handle HTML tags. So the best way that I found to deal with something like this is to remove these script tags. And you can do that in Notepad or any other text editor using search and replace, but you have to be just a little bit careful so that you don't remove more than you should. The idea is to remove these script tags to unify all of the components of the script together, so that now you can treat them just like you would treat any normal obfuscated script.
Can you write a tool to indent it?
Could you write a tool to indent it? Indenting this won't be of much help because it's all obfuscated, so it's not all that useful. But regarding... But in a different example, it doesn't actually work for this particular one. Indenting this isn't all that helpful. But actually, there is a tool to indent and colorize nicely formatted JavaScript. And that tool is Mozilla. I didn't mention it earlier, but now that you bring it up, if you look at a script in Mozilla, in the decoder tag, there's this button here called Format Code. If you click the button, it's going to clean things up and it's going to make them look much nicer. Yep. So, if you see something like this, run a search and replace. Be careful not to replace too much, but basically you want to get rid of these tags to unify script components. Another set of defensive measures that I want to show you are really some bizarre constructs that JavaScript allows you to do. I'm calling this unusual syntax and conditionals. And let me show you what I mean. Sometimes you look at a script and you see a line like this. This is JavaScript. What does this mean? It's very uncommon. If you talk to JavaScript developers, in most cases, they have never seen things like this because they're used to proper, clean, normal JavaScript. But malware developers push JavaScript construct and syntax to its limits. What does this mean? Well, normally, in parentheses like this, you could define an array. So this is an array consisting of multiple values like 9, 12, 33, etc. But what you can see is this array consisting of multiple values is assigned to a regular variable that's supposed to only store a single value. When you do this in JavaScript, the value that's going to be placed in the variable is going to be the last one. So when this executes, the variable mute will contain the characters IT. But it's not obvious to people who are not familiar with the syntax. So remember, if you see an array like this assigned to a single variable, only the last value matters. How about something like this? This is oftentimes seen in modern JavaScript. A equals this, B equals that, C equals A plus B. What's going on here? Well, what do you think is going to be in A? Right, I mentioned that only the last element of the array is looked at. So A is going to be docq. B is going to be ment. A plus B is document. So A is going to be the string document. So if you're looking for document.write, you might not see it. You might see c.write, because C is created dynamically out of docq and ment. Ah, things are getting interesting here, because this creates all sorts of possibilities. Here's another one, really bizarre syntax. There's a strange way of defining a conditional statement. Normally, these statements are created using statements like if something is true, then do this, else do something else. But there is an esoteric way of defining a conditional like that on a single line. Whew, look at this. What this really means is this. 0.2e1, this really means 2. 4e1 means 4. What this means is that if 2 is greater than or equal than 4, then assign to this variable the value 0.9075. Otherwise, assign to this variable the value I plus F, which is if. So what is RJVIJJ going to have in it? If, because 2 is not greater than or equal to 4. So this is bizarre, because RJVIJ now is going to be if, but it's not immediately obvious when you look at something like this. Why do they do this? Mostly to confuse antivirus tools, because this is a way to modify the signature of the code so that it no longer matches whatever the AV is looking for. Or an intrusion detection system, yep. All right, so how about this? Look at the bottom. This is what you might see sometimes. What you look at is A in square brackets B in round brackets C. What is that? Well, the syntax here is the following. You can do this. It's really strange. The proper way of saying document.write hello, what would be document.write hello would print hello into the document. Well, instead of saying document.write, you can say document and then write in square brackets. So you can say So A is document, B is write, C is text to print. So A square brackets B round brackets C is going to print text to print. Again, if you search for document.write, you're not going to find it. All right, things can get even more complicated. B is equal to window. So whenever you see B, it's as if it says window. What it's doing here is regular expression substitution. It says, listen, take a string ESV8ASLS and replace any one of these values with nothing. So delete S, delete capital D if it's there, delete capital H, etc., replace them with nothing. So this is going to be equal to eval. So if you look for eval by itself, it's not going to be there. They create it dynamically. And this is B in square brackets eval, which is another way of saying B dot eval, which is another way of saying window dot eval. So you're really calling here window dot eval. It's just really interesting stuff, just pushing the syntax to its limits. How about this one? This actually makes sense, strangely enough. What is going to be the result of AAA? All right, well, I tried to reformat this a little bit. All right, this is the same string, but I reformatted it to make it simpler, because you've got here multiple arrays. In an array, only the last element is going to matter. So this A, AAA, is assigned an array of two elements. The first one is going to be completely ignored, because only the last one matters, this one. Now, this element also consists of two elements, but the first one is going to be completely ignored, so only this one matters. And this one is actually that complex condition that checks to see whether .39 is less than 8. And if that's the case, then the result is going to be document. So AAA is going to contain in it document. If you search for document, nowhere to be found, because it's created dynamically.